Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and now a very special guest, Alan Alda. It's his interest in science and medicine that brings him here today, especially dyslexia, around which he's doing an event this weekend in Millbrook near Poughkeepsie. But we'll also talk about communicating science in general, which Alda is working to improve, and about his life and times a bit, and we can take some phone calls in a little while. It's such an honor to have you on the program. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. You're terrific to have me on. Thanks.
And for people not affected, the common idea is that people with dyslexia reverse letters as they read. Is that the heart of it?
You know, from what I understand, it's only part of it, and apparently not everybody with dyslexia reverses letters. But it's apparently a whole language problem, and it's processing language altogether, both through your eyes and through your ears. Some dyslexic people have trouble following a lecture, for instance, or they have trouble telling a story because the order of events is not easy for them to grasp, or context is not easy to get, so that they have to really adjust their behavior. And the reason I know this is because my granddaughter is dyslexic, and I've seen her make progress that was just extraordinary. I saw her whole personality change when she went to a school in Millbrook called the Kildonan School, which specializes in dyslexic problems. And she just became so outgoing because one of the things they taught her was to advocate for herself. And she became very outgoing and in charge of her own life.
And so are there certain facts that you most want to raise consciousness about regarding dyslexia?
You know, my experience doing broadcasting on public television about science has made me so used to and interested in talking to scientists about their work that one of the things I want to do at this event we're going to have is find out from them what they know, find out from these four experts who I'm going to be talking with on stage what they know about dyslexia and what some of the things are that we don't know that we ought to know about it. I mean, for instance, one couple, the Ides, his name is Brock Ide and Fernette Ide, they wrote a book called The Dyslexic Advantage.
I was going to ask you about that. What a title. It implies
that there's something to be gained by it.
Right.
Yeah. True. And so that it's probably not a good idea to say they suffer from dyslexia. They deal with it.
Are you familiar enough to say what might be included in the dyslexic advantage?
I was
asking
my daughter about that this morning. And apparently one of the advantages that she's aware of is an ability to see in three dimensions, acutely than the rest of us can. In other words, they can look at a two-dimensional drawing and actually see it in three dimensions. So this helps them if they want to become architects or other visual ways of working.
Or she didn't need to wear those glasses when she went to see The Hobbit.
You know, I have to ask her about that.
Alan Alda is my guest on WNYC, and we can take phone calls from anybody. So I'm not going to say suffering, and we don't tend to say that anyway about diseases here. We say people with.
Yeah,
so
right.
People with dyslexia, people who know people with dyslexia, and anything else you want to talk to Alan Alda about, how about that? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And do you want to give us the specific information about the event that's coming up on Sunday?
It's going to be at the Millbrook School in Millbrook, the Chelsea Morrison Theater. And it's a Sunday, April 21st. And I'll be talking with four experts on dyslexia, the Ides, and also Fumiko Heft and Manuel Casanova, who have just extraordinary things that they've done in their work, exploring this sometimes from an evolutionary point of view, sometimes trying to understand why. Dr. Heft, for instance, as I understand it, has identified people who had dyslexia, who, Well, we still have dyslexia because apparently it's incurable. Mm-hmm. However, they have an above-average IQ in spite of the fact that they have dyslexia. What's going on there? Why are they – and you know, many, many people are identified with having dyslexia who then go on to run huge companies and become gigantic successes, you know, like the guy with the Virgin Air and those people.
Let's take a call.
Oh,
here
okay.
is Hale in Freeport. Hello, Hale. You're on WNYC.
Hello, everybody. I love your show.
Thank you.
Anyway, I'm in the sign business for over 40 years. I grew up in Richmond Hill, Queens. I'm out in Long Island now. I make many mistakes because of dyslexia, inverting numbers, and so on and so forth. My biggest mistake was I didn't read a blueprint carefully, and it was for Power Plant 19, and I made 19 signs for that plant.
Ooh.
And that cost me a $5,000 error.
Mm.
And I tried to convince them to buy the other 19 signs. They said, well, we only have one plant called Plant 19. Also, when I dial the phone, I dial hundreds of phone calls a day. I'd say 10 to 15% of the phone calls are wrong numbers because I'm doing something else.
Mm.
I read a ruler upside down once. The sign was 16 feet. It was supposed to be 16 feet. I read the ruler upside down. It was 19 feet. My guys went to the job.
Ooh.
Sign up is 3 feet too long.
Do you experience those are, you know, very instructive for listeners not familiar with the experience. Do you experience any dyslexic advantage, anything you would label that?
I have a photographic memory. I remember every conversation with every client because later on they try to say, I said this, I said that, and, you know, uh-huh. that's my advantage. Artistically, I do sculptures and stuff like that with old signs.
Three-dimensional stuff.
Hale, thank you. Thank you
yeah,
very much.
Thank you very much. It's interesting, you know, I find...
And very candid.
Yeah, very. And it's interesting to me personally because I find that as I get older, I misdial phone numbers too. I have to check the number three times before I dial it. I don't know if I'm developing dyslexia.
It's acquired dyslexia syndrome.
Yeah. Maybe I aspire to it. But interestingly, I was wondering if he would benefit from another organization that's sponsoring this talk we're having Sunday night in Millbrook, which is Eye to Eye. Or if we would benefit from something like what they do, because what they do is they're a national organization that provide mentoring to children with dyslexia, and the mentors are high school and college students who also are dyslexic but have made it through that portion of their school experience, and they mentor them and help them get around the difficulties that dyslexia presents them with. Uh-huh. So I'm wondering if he could get together with another dyslexic who's able to handle it better and can help, give him some tips and help him navigate his way.
So, Hale, maybe you can, and that's a great suggestion from Alan Alda. On our webpage, Susan in Manhattan, dyslexia affects 20% of the population worldwide, she writes, that translates to around 240,000 New York City school children, K through 12, in any given year, very few of whom get appropriate help. As Regent Emeritus Adelaide Sanford says, we don't have an achievement gap, we have an access gap. And Susan, who writes that, says she's the director of the Right to Read Project.
Oh, that's great. It is amazing. I've read those figures, too. One study said 15% of the population had dyslexia. Another study, both leading studies, said 20%. And some people have suggested it might even be higher, depending on how you define it. But isn't it surprising to think that if you're at a table of a dozen people, how many at that table have the chance of having dyslexia, according to those figures?
Alan Alda, my guest on WNYC, with this personal connection that he's mentioned, a granddaughter with dyslexia, leading his interest. And, of course, he's interested in science in general, but his interest in this for the moment and hosting this event in Millbrook, northeast of Poughkeepsie, on Sunday. Robert in Rego Park, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, Brian. How you doing, guy? Great job. Mr. Alda, you're doing a great job also. I'd like to ask you a question. In the future, with the science fair that you guys do with Ms. Dr. Green from Columbia,
right.
Will you be doing any topics like the integration of science, philosophy, and religion? Because couple of thousand years ago, was all integrated, consciousness, science, instead of just isolating science. Will you be doing an interesting topic that integrates all the different categories?
You know, I think we have had a couple of events that dealt in some way with what you're asking about. And the Templeton Foundation, which is interested in that, is one of the founding sponsors of the World Science Festival. But, you know, we do 40 or 50 events a year just during that 1 week that we do the festival. So we've done several hundred events now. So I can't remember all of the ones, and I don't remember if we've covered that specifically, what you're asking for. So, but I think we have.
Tell us about your Center for Communicating Science at Stony Brook University. Why communicating science?
Well, it's kind of basic. Is it enough to do science? If you don't communicate it, it's almost like the tree falling in the forest. Has it really happened? You need to communicate it so that other scientists can replicate it. You need to communicate it so that the public will understand it and support it. And policymakers. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they don't get it, why would they fund it if they don't know what it is? You're not going to give money to things you don't understand. And a number of members of Congress have told me they have not understood the scientists coming to them asking for funding.
Did you happen to see the poll that came out last year showing political conservatives' belief in not just evolution, but science in general, has been dropping for decades, down to about 35% as of last year?
No, I saw that. It's kind of shocking, because what's interesting is some of those same people are very interested in a robust economy. Our economy runs on science, and almost every economy does. At least it's sparked by science. And therefore, if you don't want science to be the currency intellectually in the land, how is it going to be the currency monetarily in the land?
Tell us, I'm curious, do you teach anything at Stony Brook? I know you did.
I do. I'm what you call a visiting professor there, which I do. I do drive-by teaching. So I mainly work on strategizing and working out our plans because our hope is that centers for communicating science will flourish all over the country, so that as scientists get their science education, they'll be getting an education in the skills of communication.
So is that what you teach? Is it science communication?
Yes. Yeah. How to communicate your work so that people can understand it who don't have your exact same background in education.
You doing anything in the theater department, acting or directing on the side?
No. Well, you mean, do I do my day job too? Yeah, I do my day job. Or are you talking about the scientists?
Well, I meant teaching.
No. Actually, we have an innovative way of getting scientists to be present and related to the audiences they speak to, which is we teach them improvising. In the same way you would teach actors, but our intention is not to turn them into actors. And it's not comedic improvising, but it's highly rule-based, which scientists easily attach themselves to because they like rules, but it opens them up to the people they're working with and eventually opens them up to the audience. And it's extraordinary to see the changes. It transforms them. It's wonderful to see.
And if you're a scientist used to the rules of evidence, you say, improvising? No, wait, I can't
do that. On the contrary, what's interesting, especially younger scientists, love the idea that they're going to play and open up. They love that. And many, many older scientists, too.
Jessica in Piscataway, you're on WNYC with Alan Alda. Hello.
Hello. I was calling just to say how dyslexia was described to me when I was a child. I wound up working with a doctor who had helped my cousin with dyslexia and then wound up going to a school for dyslexics. And the way it was described was that the brain of a dyslexic is like a telephone operator switchboard back when they plugged in and you would call in to the operator. And the information comes in through your ears and your eyes, and then the operator has to give an output. And instead of giving the correct telephone number, it's a number usually kind of close to it. And one of the things that I have a hard time with is I'm always misspeaking. And I know we all do it, but I do it on such a high level.
You haven't done it yet. You speak really well. This is good.
Oh, thank you. And so that's kind of how dyslexia is described. People always say, don't you see letters backwards? And that's just not something that affects me at all. And even if you did see letter backward, if you always saw that letter backward, that letter would always have that sound.
Right.
So
right.
It definitely has to do with a connection between the two hemispheres of the brain, and that was a lot of things that when we went to that school, they would talk about, you know, what they believed
and
how it's affecting the brain.
Is that still the way it's described, you think?
I don't know. I'm almost 40, so.
Yeah.
But that's how it was. They're
learning more
the
all the time. Well, you know, my granddaughter has the experience sometimes not just of letters getting mixed up or looking backwards, but they sometimes seem to flow off the page. And in addition to that, she has the problem of hearing words and get concepts and sorting them out. So it's difficult to hear lectures sometimes.
Thank you for your call, Jessica.
Thank you.
So let's talk about your day job for a couple of minutes. You have anything in the works?
I did some shows with Laura Linney on her television series called The Big C. I love working with her, so I had a lot of fun doing that. So I think they'll be on soon.
We have a question on our webpage from a listener. Stephen, New Jersey, writes, ask him if he's still bummed about losing the election to Matt Santos on West Wing.
You said it. I was in there to win. And as a matter of fact, I think I annoyed the other actor because even off camera I wanted to win. We were on a radio interview once, and I was campaigning on the interview.
Let me ask you about a political involvement in real life from the past. One of your most high-profile political involvements, you teamed with First Lady Betty Ford and others to promote the Equal Rights Amendment in the 1970s.
Yeah, I spent about 10 years doing that. When I wasn't on camera someplace, I'd be out driving up and down roads in Oklahoma and Illinois and Florida trying to pigeonhole lapel hole. What do they call that when you buttonhole?
Oh, you're buttonholing potential voters and elected officials.
And trying to get the state senators and assembly people to listen to the arguments in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment.
So my question is, how much do you think that women's equality has progressed to the same point today through other means as it would have with the ERA?
That's such an interesting question, because three of the arguments that I heard most frequently against the Equal Rights Amendment were that it would require same-sex marriage, it would force women to work in the military to be in combat, and it would require same-sex bathrooms, none of which, by the way, would have been required by the Equal Rights Amendment. But that's what they were afraid of, and those were the fears that the population was being played to. The interesting thing is, without the Equal Rights Amendment, all three of those things are happening or have happened.
Women fought for the right to fight on the front lines in combat.
And they're in a way, they're in the front lines in combat in that particular kind of war. You can't be there without being on the front lines. But they don't get the credit for it. They don't get the pay for it and all kinds of things like that. And I'd like to see nobody – and my argument in those days was, please, I'd like to see men and women not be in combat.
And indeed. And what about men? Another of your contributions was being a feminist era role model as a sensitive but not wimpy guy.
Well, I got credit for being wimpy, too, in those days.
by your antagonist.
Wimps of the world unite.
How much do you think masculinity in this country has been changing ever since?
I think a little bit. And I'm very happy that I made some little contribution to that. I think men feel freer now to express their emotions, to not have to hold everything in and be the tough, strong, silent type. You can go too far with that, of course, and men and women both can trade too freely on that. But I think I see more, especially with the younger men, a willingness to take over half child rearing, half. I think it's even in my own family, the social calendar is mostly run by my wife. Sometimes things just boil down that way. We often share cooking, but she really knows how to cook. You know?
Considering what you just said about hopefully the men wouldn't have to go to the military either, and of course considering your work on MASH, and I was reading up on you yesterday, and I was surprised to see you were in ROTC in college. Did Wikipedia get that right?
Got that part right, but Wikipedia did not get the part right. I was not born in the Bronx, as it said here, and I was not a gunnery officer in Korea. I don't know where they got that.
Tom Hanks was on the station recently, and the host asked him, oh, I hear you were born wherever it was. And he said, oh, I see you read Wikipedia.
That's what I say to people, too.
did you have an evolution of beliefs on things military, though?
No. I was only in the ROTC, so when I got shot at, it would be as an officer and not an enlisted man. I just thought that would probably be a safer. That turns out it's not safer. They shoot at the bars, you know.
you're just protecting your backside.
Yeah.
You were a force for taking television to the next level with MASH in its day as a sitcom that could deal with serious issues and work on both levels. Are you surprised at how much quality there is on TV today, even while there's a lot of junk? Or wouldn't you characterize TV as having a lot of quality?
Well, there seems to be, I don't watch as much television as most people do, but I get the impression there's a wonderful fund of quality television to be found on cable,
mm-hmm.
and some junk on cable too. But it is interesting that as they've divided up the audience, I mean, when I was on television in my prime of my life, there was. There were only three networks, and they divided up the whole audience pretty much. Now it's fragmented so that a hit show can have just a couple of million viewers or a few million viewers. In the old days, it was 30 million. And now they can maybe appeal to a special audience, and certainly the Internet appeals to a special audience. That is to say, the people who are really interested in seeing seeing Downton Abbey have something to focus on, and there's a show for them to watch.
Did you have to fight the network in those days to take MASH in the direction you wanted to? Because it was really kind of a two-era program. There was the Yuck, Yuck, Yuck old-style military comedy program, and then I think there was the second half. Tell me if you disagree with this characterization, when you were more in charge of the creative direction.
No, you know, that's the other thing that the Internet has a little bit wrong about my contribution to MASH. When I started getting a credit as creative consultant, but that didn't mean I was more creative or more consulted. I still wrote for the show and I directed. But I didn't change the direction of the show. That was the product of the new producers who came in, mm-hmm. and new writers who came in. If it changed, I didn't change it. And I don't think it changed the way people think. It was more political under Larry Gelbart. He did more political satire.
The early days.
In the early days. And I never tried to push a political agenda. So I'm glad to say this out loud once. But I do think that the first part of your question was true. We did have to struggle with the network to get more serious. First time somebody died on the show, the guy who ran the network said, "What is this, a situation tragedy?" And he didn't realize that that was going to be our strength, that we could be funny and serious at the same time.
Anything captivating you politically these days in particular?
No, I'll tell you, for about the past 30 years, I have not said anything political in public. I grouse in private to my friends and
Why?
My family. I wanted to concentrate. I really did spend so much time trying to get the Equal Rights Amendment passed. I really feel that I gave it the office. And I want to concentrate now on the things that I think I do best and where I can make the best contribution.
We did a series last year on the program called End of War, asking all kinds of folks if they think humanity can ever abolish war, kind of like we've mostly abolished slavery, which was once just accepted, mm-hmm. even in the Bible. Mm-hmm. Have you ever asked yourself that question?
I have. I ask myself that question almost every time I read the newspaper. How long is this going to go on? Can we survive as a species if we have that ability, that proclivity, and the tools to murder one another and to murder the earth? I don't know how. I often ask at the dinner table, how long does everybody here think our species can survive? Can we survive our own intelligence and our inclination to hurt one another? I don't get it. I don't know how long it can take. I mean, I don't know how long we can last. You know, the average species lasts about 2 million years. Do we have any chance of being average?
So that's funny. Dude, that's a denunciation, though. That's not...
It's a question.
Prediction as to...
Oh, how can you have a prediction? I don't know.
You don't know.
Do you have a prediction?
Whether you can end war or not?
Oh, whether you can end war? well, I'd like to see war ended. I'd like to see poverty ended. I think we need to know more about how we work. And maybe the new brain science will teach us how we work, and we can use it for good. The trouble is every time we get some new information, like on radioactivity, we figure out a way to use it for destruction, you know?
In general, are you an optimist or a pessimist about the future?
I don't think I'm either one. I think I'm curious for the evidence. I want to see what people – smarter people than me are – figuring out about this. Well, how are you? What are you? Are you an optimist or a pessimist?
Oh, I tend to be an optimist. I don't want to go into it now because we're running out of time.
Oh,
people
okay.
want to hear you.
Well,
but,
I
look at the big arc of history as generally heading in the right direction.
I think I'm optimistic about all the things I'm pessimistically viewing. I mean, I think it's you need to be a little bit of both. That makes you skeptical to be a pessimist. You got to be skeptical to get anywhere. And so I don't optimistically accept every good news I hear.
But you have to fight, even as an optimist, to make that progress actually come about.
That's true. Yeah. You got to just keep looking for the edge for the positive, I guess.
Alan Alda will be moderating a program on dyslexia Sunday night at the Millbrook School in Millbrook, New York. It's a little bit northeast of Poughkeepsie at their Chelsea Morrison Theater. The address is 131 Millbrook Road. In Millbrook, New York. You can get tickets at the website of the Kildonan School, where his dyslexic daughter attends. And
it's
granddaughter.
Yeah, granddaughter, Kildonan, kildonan.org.
And thank you so much.
Thank you. What a treat. I'm so pleased to be able to talk to you. I listen to you all the time. You're great.
And what an honor for me. Thank you very, very
much.
Thank you. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.